This is Central Time. Now, December 1st marks World AIDS Day. The event recognizes those who have passed away from AIDS and those still living with it. Each year, World AIDS Day picks a new theme. This year's theme is Equalize, focusing on the inequalities within HIV treatment around the country and around the world. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have HIV or AIDS affected you or a loved one? Do you have ways of showing your support for those dealing with the disease AIDS? How do you think AIDS support could change for the better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is an associate professor of medicine and population health sciences in the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison. Dr. Westergaard, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be with you.
Can you talk about the state of AIDS worldwide? I think it's receded in the public attention because of some successful treatments we'll talk about. It clearly hasn't gone away, though.
That's exactly right. Globally, there's about 1.5 million new cases of HIV in the world every year. Here in the United States, that number has plateaued at around 35,000 new cases. That's despite a great deal of progress that's been done with treating people and preventing HIV. Medications have been responsible for saving millions of lives of people with HIV, and people who get infected today can expect to live a long, healthy life if they're promptly linked to treatment. But as you said, we've not yet ended the epidemic, and now World AIDS Day is an opportunity to focus our energy on what needs to be done in the future to meet that goal.
Now let's talk about treatment. There isn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, there isn't a cure for HIV AIDS, but there are treatments that make it, I mean, originally it was in effect a death sentence. It's not anymore. Can you talk about some of the treatments that have changed things so much?
Yeah, thanks. World AIDS Day is a time to not only remember people that have been lost, but also reflect on what is really a triumph of medicine and public health in reducing deaths due to HIV/AIDS. Antiviral medications have been around since the early 90s, so-called triple therapy or highly active therapy, where we use three medications all together, has been around since about 1996. And since those types of treatments have been available, the risk of death from AIDS in this country has plummeted to very, very low levels. The treatments have continued to get better since then, to the point where most of my patients these days who have HIV take a single pill, which has all three medications co-formulated together one time a day with minimal side effects. And as a result, more than 9 times out of 10, the virus is undetectable in their body and they feel well and are leading a healthy life.
As I mentioned, the theme of this year's World AIDS Day is Equalize. Can you talk about access to the treatments you're talking about and where we might not have equality around the world?
Well, this is one of the real unacceptable situations in HIV/AIDS globally and also here in Wisconsin. Here in Wisconsin, because of the access to treatment and prevention services, we're what is considered a low prevalence state. So we have about 240 to 260 new HIV cases diagnosed in Wisconsin every year, and that's compared to over 30,000 in the United States. But what's unacceptable about our data in Wisconsin shows that people who are racial and ethnic minorities make up the large majority of infections. So despite comprising only 19% of Wisconsin's populations, Wisconsin residents who identify as Black or Hispanic represent 66% of new HIV diagnoses. Now, this has nothing to do with the virus. This has to do with our systems of care and prevention, access to services, and traditional injustices that exist in our healthcare system. So when we think about how we need to improve HIV care in the future, we need to think about equitable access to all the life-saving and disease-preventing resources that have been developed over the past 40 years of the HIV epidemic.
We're talking to Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Associate Professor of Medicine and Population Health Sciences in the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison. With us talking about World AIDS Day, which is today. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience, your own, someone in your family, your friends affected by HIV and AIDS, do you have questions about treatment, prevention, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Associate Professor of Medicine and Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, with us talking about World AIDS Day that's marked today, December 1st each year. Dr. Westergaard, let's turn to prevention. This was once the center, I think, of public messaging about HIV and AIDS. Have we dropped the ball a little bit on prevention?
Well, I would say we've been stuck at a low level and have things that we can do to make more progress. Certainly, the incidence, meaning the number of new infections of HIV, has dropped since its peak in the 1990s, but it has plateaued, as I said. So what do we need to do to improve that situation? Well, two things. One is people should understand that there's a recommendation in all healthcare settings that people ages 13 to 64 should be tested for HIV at least once in their life. People who have risk factors should get tested more often than that. The reason for that is because most new HIV infections in this country are transmitted from people who don't know that they're infected. Once people test positive, they're linked to treatment, they're started on medications, the virus is undetectable, and they're no longer able to transmit the virus. So if identifying people who have HIV, so no one is living in the community unaware that they're infected and are at risk to people that they're in contact with, is priority number one. Number two is that we have tools that can prevent HIV transmission among people who are at risk, most notably something called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. This is a highly effective once-a-day medication, and there's new research on monthly or bi-monthly injections that can be used for the same purpose, that for people who are exposed to HIV, it will prevent infections. So these are valuable tools. They are very effective tools. They're frankly underutilized. So our colleagues, our partners in the medical community and the general public need to know that they're available and make use of them if we're going to increase our success in preventing new HIV infections in the future.
The White House announced a budget request for $850 million in next year's budget, working toward a goal, they say, of eliminating HIV/AIDS by 2030. Where would you see the most value for dollars spent from the U.S. government in helping to reach that goal?
Well, it's not one thing. It's one of the things that the HIV response has taught us is that we have to use the combination of highly effective or evidence-based strategies all together. So the great success that we've gotten to date in the HIV epidemic is a suite of services, prevention, treatment, harm reduction, that when used and given equitable access to the communities that need them, can reduce the risk of HIV. So we need to do more of what works. There's not one magic bullet. There hopefully someday will be a vaccine where we can talk about eliminating HIV as a virus that affects humans, but we're not there yet. So in the meantime, we need to use all the evidence-based strategies for people who are both infected and people who are at risk to make sure that we can reduce transmission to the lowest level possible.
I wanted to ask about vaccines. We had a disease like the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, able to turn around a vaccine pretty quickly. HIV seems like a much more difficult target. Why is that?
It's really interesting science, and it's been a real challenge. HIV is arguably among the most highly studied and researched viruses that we've ever had. Some of the smartest people in science are working on HIV vaccines, and we've not yet figured it out. The reason, in a nutshell, is the property of the virus that causes the proteins on the outside of the virus to change their shape, to evolve, to mutate. Essentially, they change so quickly that as soon as we make a vaccine that could target one virus, the virus will change into a form that the vaccine will no longer target. So then the next phase of vaccine research is developing something called broadly neutralizing antibodies, which can cover and neutralize a larger swath of the virus. So this is what's showing promise. There are some clinical trials right now with vaccines that induce the formation of these broadly neutralizing antibodies. I've heard that we can expect to see some data in 2024. So there's some excitement, there's some hope on the horizon, but you're exactly right. This has been one of the most frustrating viruses to develop vaccines for. But I believe we're still hopeful that we'll get there eventually.
And AIDS is a disease that affects, among other things, our immune systems. How did that affect people as COVID emerged? Were people with AIDS at higher risk?
Well, as I mentioned before, most people who are living with HIV are living healthy lives and doing well because they're on antiretroviral therapy, which suppresses the virus down to undetectable levels. People who are not on effective therapy, the minority of folks, or people for whatever reason have had a long history of poorly treated infection and now have a weak immune system, they indeed belong in that category of people who can get more severe disease, not with just COVID, but with a great deal of other infectious diseases. So on the population level, it wasn't a very large risk factor for severe COVID, but those individuals that did have severe immunosuppression due to HIV were at higher risk, and we've given them recommendations similar to people who have organ transplants or cancer to try to protect themselves with booster doses and monoclonal antibodies and using all the tools that we have.
Today is again World AIDS Day, and part of the effort is to bring public attention to the disease, get people thinking about it. What would you hope listeners take away from World AIDS Day?
Well, one thing I'd like us to think about as we reflect on the good things, the accomplishments of HIV is we were able to take the number one cause of death among young and middle-aged adults in 1995, and with the suite of treatments, advocacy, social support, take it out of the top five. HIV/AIDS was public health threat number one back then. And the things that we did to support people living with HIV through federal legislation like the Ryan White CARE Act turned it into a much lower concern for public health. So, what is our number one cause of death among young adults and middle-aged adults right now? Well, it's drug overdose. The same kind of support, the humane treatment, the access to prevention and treatment, non-stigmatizing care that has become the hallmark of HIV care in this country. We need to use those lessons that we've learned on how to take care of people with chronic conditions and apply them to the people in our community who are suffering from substance use disorder and need help. So that's one message I think on this World AIDS Day I'd like people to take away is that we know how to take care of people who are struggling with diseases, who are suffering from stigma. We can use those lessons, we can take that care that we've developed for HIV and apply it to the public health crisis of our day today.
I'd love to have you back to talk about that more. Dr. Westergaard, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, and thank you for recognizing World AIDS Day with us.
That's Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Associate Professor of Medicine and Population Health Sciences in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Westergaard joined us today to talk about World AIDS Day, recognized every year on December 1st. Coming up, a lot of big cities have established LGBTQ communities, but what does that community look like outside of the Midwest's largest urban centers? We talked to the author of the new book, Queering the Midwest, about her time trying to answer that question in a small Midwestern city. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. LGBTQ community can mean a lot of different things. It can mean places like bars or coffee shops where everyone feels welcome. It could mean local groups involved in activism on LGBTQ issues. Can mean a network of supportive relationships. That kind of social infrastructure is often associated with the biggest cities. But our next guest wants to know what life for LGBTQ folks looks like outside of large urban centers. So she spent time researching that question in one small city here in the Midwest. Claire Forstie is a teaching consultant at the University of Minnesota's Center for Educational Innovation. Her new book is called Queering the Midwest, Forging LGBTQ Community. Claire, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me to talk with you.
What got you interested in exploring this issue, but not in the biggest cities where we might think there are, you know, big communities and community centers?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, for me, it's actually very much a personal story. I am a queer community member who has lived in, grew up in small cities and towns in the Midwest and in New England. And for me, I know from my own experience and from research that our stories are not told really that as often as they should be. So I felt that I wanted to learn about a particular small city, River City. And I was curious about the lives of members of community members of that small city. So part of my research was spending time in River City, interviewing LGBTQ community members there. And that's why I focused on their stories.
And let's talk about River City. That's a pseudonym. You wanted to cover up the actual name of the city and the people. So you're not, you know, sharing their stories when they didn't want them to be shared. But set it up River City for a little bit. On the face of it, people looking in from the outside might say, well, no, that's not going to be a friendly place.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, River City is a small city that is located pretty far away from the nearest large cities. That's a dimension that really matters for what community looks like. And so that was part of kind of my focus, was thinking through what the experience of LGBTQ people is in a small city that's maybe a regional hub that has towns around it where people travel to that small city for shopping and for other community things. So that's the context a bit of River City. And that's right. It is a pseudonym. I can't share exactly where the city is, but it is here in the Midwest.
So talk a little bit about what you did. You started with some census data and other things, but a lot of this was talking to and meeting people in River City.
Yeah, absolutely. So part of what I do as an ethnographer is I talk to people. I conducted interviews, 54 interviews, with LGBTQ community members and allies. And I attended a lot of LGBTQ community events. So some of the things that you described earlier, everything from, you know, small nonprofits to pride events, pride picnics, to drag shows, all kinds of, you know, book readings, things like that. All kinds of events where I could observe what was going on in the local LGBTQ community.
Now, the word ambivalence comes up a lot in the book. Some people really liked the situation there. Some didn't. A lot of people were in between. Can you talk, first of all, about some of the positives about living in River City that people talk to you about as LGBTQ residents?
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't want to tell what I knew to be a simple story, right? It's complicated. So there were some community members who really loved living in River City. They loved the size of the community. They loved the connections they could make. Maybe they were from there. They had family members there. They had connections to spiritual and religious communities there. And they felt the amenities really fit their interests. They also really liked that it was affordable, right? It was a place they could afford to live and work and build really close relationships with other community members. For other community members, though, it was a little bit more complicated. If folks were not from River City, if they didn't fit with the local faith tradition, if they were not white, they had a lot more challenges finding a sense of community and really feeling like they fit in. So as you said, with the word ambivalence, it's kind of a both and story. So it's a little bit of some folks felt really welcome, felt a strong sense of community, and other folks really struggled and really had a hard time finding that sense of community. I'll share that the highest proportion of folks that I interviewed who cried in my interviews were the ones who really didn't find that sense of community, and many of them ended up leaving. I think that says something about how we think about the future of these communities for those of us who still do live in small cities.
And I think a really important note that comes out really strongly in your book is people might think of a gay community or an LGBTQ community and paint with a broad brush. Even in a fairly small community in this small city, there is a wide diversity of experience, self-definition, and even interest in considering someone a part of a community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of what I was aiming for was getting at that range of people's identities and experiences and what community looked like to them, what kinds of community they valued. For some people, it was going to a drag show. For other folks, it was attending an event at a library. For others who were, you know, involved in activism, it was organizing marches, community events. It was organizing the annual Pride picnic. And for some folks, it was gathering with a group of like-minded friends and going on a hike. So there certainly are a range of activities, a range of organizations that fall under that really broad umbrella that we think of as LGBTQ community. I want to be clear, gay bars are important, right? They're very important in this moment. And there is so much more than we think exists about LGBTQ communities. There's a broad range of activities, broad range of identities.
Talking to Claire Forstie about her book, Queering the Midwest, Forging LGBTQ Community. She focused on a small city here in the Midwest to look at those issues of community. Claire, one tragic event that seems like it brought people together there. I think while you were doing your work there, the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting back in 2016. Can you talk about how that community that didn't always feel like a community really came together after that?
Yeah, I am so glad you asked that question. One of the most powerful experiences for me as a researcher was to see just how quickly community members and allies, who are a central aspect of communities in small cities, came together to organize a really beautiful memorial event following that shooting, which we remember from a few years ago, and which has echoes today. And so what I remember from this event was we had a small program and we had images of all the people who had been killed in the shooting. And folks had time to spend some time and space looking at these images and thinking about the lives of folks who were lost. This was something that I saw just about every single one of the people I interviewed show up at this event. And there were community leaders who came too. And what I love about this event is that, to me, it gives me a bit of hope about the future, that folks can and do mobilize when something terrible happens. And it makes me think about what's possible too in the future.
A lot of people you talk to, whether they're part of the LGBTQ community or allies or others, talked about how River City had, in their view, in any way, anyways, changed over the years. In some ways, many people thought in a positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. There were a number of folks I talked to who said, for some reason, the time limit was 20 years. Over the last 20 years, things had really, really rapidly changed in River City, where there started to be spaces where LGBTQ people could be visible and accepted, and folks really appreciated the progress that had happened up to that point. And it's complicated, right? There certainly were still challenges too, but I really heard a number of times that sense of things really have changed. And I think that matches with the national narrative too quite a bit.
A common question for people in River City was, should I stay or should I go? Should I seek out a bigger city that has a bigger, more established community? It's interesting because we often think of, you know, a gay community in a large city, for example, but there's nothing inherently about being LGBTQ that says, I want to live in a big city as opposed to maybe the Midwestern small city or, for that matter, rural area I grew up in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That stay or go question is huge. I think those of us who've grown up in and lived in small cities get that question a lot, kind of like, why are you here? Why are you still here? And there are lots of really good reasons why people do stay. And sometimes there are reasons why folks leave, although they don't always leave for big cities. Sometimes folks leave small cities for other small cities. And so that local context and whether folks can find a space there really matters for that decision. And especially whether folks are able to find friends, able to find family, community, and a sense of belonging, that's part of their decision for why to stay or go. Sometimes they go to other small cities.
One other thing I wanted to ask about, we're not going to cover everything in your book, people talk in some cases about, yeah, this is an accepting community as long as I don't stick out too much.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that is a little bit of a straightforward story. I heard that from many folks, that if I don't out myself, if I stay under the radar, thinking of one participant in particular who said, if I let folks know that I'm a young trans man, I fear for my safety. And so I heard that over and over, as long as I'm not, as another participant said, too rah, rah, shish, kumbah, gay, I'll be okay. And so that's something, again, gives us some clues about where there's some space for improvement in the communities that we live in.
Do you have thoughts in just our last minute and a half or so about how smaller communities, if people want to, can help create, welcoming environments where people don't have to be shy about sticking out in those ways?
I do. What is really important in small cities and towns are relationships, right? So the relationships that we have with each other, leveraging those relationships, whether it is maybe bringing a sibling or even a parent to an LGBTQ event, maybe making sure to stand up for our LGBTQ friends in those relationships. I think really leveraging those relationships to build acceptance and to build that sense of community and to show up at events in different ways, right? So often activists were tired, burned out. So any work that we can do to support the good work that's already being done and leaning on those relationships, I feel like I say it a lot, but they really, really matter, especially in small cities and towns.
Claire, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
That's Clara Forsty, teaching consultant at the University of Minnesota's Center for Educational Innovation. She was with us today talking about her new book. It's called Queering the Midwest, Forging LGBTQ Community.